Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, we'll be hearing about an illustrated talk on the Askard in Dublin by sailor Pat Murphy. Brian Carlin, sailor, photographer and filmmaker, on his adventures in the Clipper Ventures Round the World Yacht Race. First this week, we go to a remarkable story which brings together the voyaging of the city of Florence and Captain William Leask, and links Sligo, Stromness, Spain, Nova Scotia and New York. The story of the Mary Celeste is one of the greatest maritime mysteries and has been quoted widely in much of the coverage of the missing Malaysian Airways aircraft in the past fortnight. The brigantine was found abandoned off the coast of Spain in 1872 and was immortalised in literature as the Mary Celeste by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. Now, Seascapes can reveal in a maritime detective story worthy of Holmes himself the compelling new evidence about what really happened to the ill-fated sailing ship and her crew. The intrepid Kieran Devaney has this exclusive.
Come forth, you sea dogs, and sit for a spell as I tell you about the mystery of an old sailing tale. Of a ship from New York and a seven-man crew, the captain, his wife, and their young daughter too.
Sailing into nowhere, the ghost ship the Mary Celeste, found abandoned off the coast of Spain. Captain Benjamin Briggs, his crew, his wife Sarah, and two-year-old daughter Sophie, missing in one of the greatest seafaring mysteries of our time. Now, for the first time, we can lay those ghosts to rest. Exonerate a crew of a ship accused of murder and piracy, and tell the true story about what happened aboard a sailing ship which was cursed and damned from the day her keel was laid. Furthermore, we can reveal how the Mary Celeste was discovered and boarded hours or maybe days before history shows she was found by the Canadian vessel, the Dea Gratia. The story of what happened to the captain's missing sextant and chronometer, and maybe, just maybe, reveal the final resting place of her crew and passengers.
Some say she was cursed by the cargo she carried, never finding a soul or a thing to be buried.
Our story starts in the Orkney Islands.
Where is the crew of the Mary Celeste? The ship was found derelict, seaworthy and blessed.
Patricia Long is the great-grandniece of William Leask, who in December 1872 was first mate of the city of Florence.
They were on voyage from London to Melbourne. They spotted this ship sailing with no sign of life on board. So William Leask was mate at the time, and the captain sent him across in charge of a small boat to investigate. And he found a ship that didn't look as if it had been abandoned. The crew seemed to be expecting to come back. Everything was just sitting there, just left lying.
Leask family folklore tells us the vessel was the Mary Celeste, a month out from New York and bound for Genoa in Italy.
We certainly know they took the sextant. This is the intriguing thing, because my grandfather can remember seeing the sextant, his uncle said, was the sextant from the Mary Celeste. In official reports, the chronometer's missing as well, and perhaps the captain got that. But it's only the sextant we really know seems to have been in the family at one time.
Patricia's grandfather was Hargrave Walter Leask. He recalled conversations with William in a 1961 recording found buried in the Orkney Sound Archives.
Everything is perfect, order. Nothing missing whatsoever. The captain's wife must have been aboard. There was a reel standing in the top of the sewing machine, and it couldn't have been in bad weather. The reel wasn't falling off. He took the sextant with him as a souvenir. So, and they... The sextant I've seen time and time again. The sextant was in the, what we used to call was a museum, where he had all his curios. Every sort of curio imaginably had picked up all over the world. Shells and coins and swords and flying fishes, albatrosses, goodness knows what.
The story that has come down to a couple of the branches, the family at least, is that the Strand magazine wrote an article about the Mary Celeste after my great-granduncle had died, and the family wrote off to the magazine to tell them about the family connection. The magazine didn't believe them, so they posted the sextant to them and never saw it again.
Sadly, the Strand magazine closed down in March 1950, and all my attempts to find descendants of the publishers have failed. But crucially, it did run an article on the Mary Celeste in November 1913. When the Dea Gratia's crew discovered the Mary Celeste on December the 4th, 1872, no one knew that William Leask had been aboard before. The Dea Gratia's crew were later accused of piracy and murder on the high seas. Officially exonerated, they never totally shook off the finger of suspicion. But if it can be proved that the city of Florence found the Mary Celeste first, then the names can be finally cleared. Over a pint in a pub on the banks of the Liffey, I asked Charlie McCarthy, a yachtsman and maritime historian, to use shipping and weather records from December 1872 and modern navigational aids to chart the Mary Celeste's movements in the days before her crew and passengers disappeared.
Could the city of Florence have found her first?
I think it's possible. She was in the area. The city of Florence left the Lizards on the 2nd and ran into a horrendous gale where she lost her bulwarks and some rigging. Her mainstay, I think, was snapped. She was in a very heavy gale, and it probably was able to sail her at her full rate. She could have reached the Azores before the 4th of December, in the region of 1,000 miles, but she could have done it. And she was definitely in the area. If she arrived at the Azores on the 4th and was able to board the Mary Celeste, it's very possible she was there, and I think highly likely.
So what did happen to the passengers and crew of the Mary Celeste? The fate has been the subject of years of speculation. Theories range from waterspouts, underwater earthquakes, UFOs, sea monsters, and even the Bermuda Triangle. But Charlie McCarthy has a far simpler explanation. Captain Briggs ordered all hands to the lifeboats, but always intended to return back on board his vessel. The theory is not entirely new, but it's given fresh credence by a discovery that he left his valuable sextant behind to be taken by William Leask.
The chronometer and the sextant were missing, but the other strange thing is that there was a rope missing, the top halyard, and a similar type of rope was made fast, secured to the ship and trailing behind with the end all frayed. It would seem that they panicked. Cargo was a cargo of alcohol. When it was being discharged later, when the ship was salvaged in Gibraltar, it was discovered 9 of the barrels were empty. So we can only assume that the fumes leached back into the accommodation and may have flashed up the stove and scared the life out of the captain and crew. So it would seem that he immediately abandoned ship by getting into the ship's boat, which was stowed on the top of the hatch, to tow along behind the ship and hope to reboard her when the fumes had cleared. But the wheel wasn't lashed, that the ship veered off, and the sudden veer put terrible pressure on the painter that they used to tow in the boat and snapped it and left them helpless with the ship sailing away from them.
Months later, a ship's boat, or depending which report you read, two makeshift rafts, were washed up on the coast of Spain on the aptly named Playa de Silencio, the beach of silence. 6 badly decomposed bodies were on board. One was wrapped in the American flag. Could these have been all that was left of Captain Benjamin Briggs, his crew, and his wife and little daughter?
Do you think we finally uncovered the truth?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible. If we could find the sextant, it would be colossal value. The chronometer might even turn up somewhere as well. And it must be somewhere.
Pat Long, for one, is happy.
Well, it's, of course, the Mary Celeste is a quite intriguing story, and to have some family connection to it. Because, you know, you get family stories, and so often they seem to have grown up around a kernel of truth, and it's been embroidered over the years. But it does seem that William Leask was telling it as it was, and that City of Florence was in the right place at the right time.
William Leask went on to become Captain Leask of the city of Florence, rounding Cape Horn more than 40 times. But as if the curse of the Mary Celeste had followed him, he and his ship were both destined for a tragic end.
He was only, I think it's about 51. He'd died of what I think was a brain tumour. He'd been hit on the head with a marlin spike a few years earlier by a steward that he'd caught stealing. And it's suggested that that could have had something to do with it. He can point that he had to leave the ship. He was regarded as such a lucky captain that the shipping line apparently tried to get him to stay on the ship, although he could no longer captain it. But he couldn't do that. He's supposed to have sort of patted the ship as he left and said, "Well, Florence, it won't be long now." And she was wrecked two voyages later in Half Moon Bay in San Francisco, I think. And he died about 2 years after that.
And so ends the story of the city of Florence and the ghost ship, the Mary Celeste.
Come forth, you sea dogs, and sit for a spell. As I tell you about the mystery of an old sailing tale, of a ship from New York and a 7-man crew, the captain, his wife, and their young daughter too.
The Strains of the Ballad of the Mary Celeste by 8th Avenue. That report was from Kieran Devaney, with thanks to Trevor Sweeney for audio assistance. Seascapes would also like to acknowledge the participation of Patricia Long, great-grandniece of Captain William Leask, the original first mate on the City of Florence, BBC Radio Orkney and the Orkney Sound Archive. You can read and see more on this remarkable story on the Seascapes webpage, which is www.rte.ie/radio1/seascapes. And would you believe, Seascapes listener John Innes was in touch to let us know that the Dei Gratia, built in Nova Scotia in 1871 and which came to discover the Mary Celeste, sailed out of the port of Yall until she was lost at the turn of the last century in a storm on the 27th of December 1907. Congratulations to boat builders Safe Haven Marine, who've been awarded Best Pilot Boat Builder of 2013 by the marine publication Work Boat World. Next here on Seascapes, to our competition winners, who each receive a copy of the lavishly produced The Old Pier Union Hall by Paul and Aileen Finucane. The answer to our Seascapes quiz was Union Hall is located in Glendore Harbour. And the winners who answered correctly are Mary O'Kane in Belfast, M. Hegarty in the Commons Road in Cork, Sean O'Connor of Templeogue in Dublin, Tom Taff in County Meath, and Anne Harrington in Blackrock, County Dublin. Many thanks for all your entries, both by postcard and email. Now on Seascapes, to a young man who began his sailing with Tralee Bay Sailing Club in Finet. He's sailed his way around the world in the past few months in the Clipper Ventures Round the World Yacht Race. He's Brian Carlin, and a few days ago, before he headed to Palma in Mallorca to film Saskia Tidy and Andrea Webster, he talked to Seascapes about his exploits.
A lot of sailing experience that I thought I had before I got on this race, and I've learned so much more even just being on these boats. And seeing what the world has to offer as well. I mean, we've travelled to I don't know how many countries at this stage, and we've done 30,000 odd nautical miles. It changes a person, that's for sure. I suppose the big ones was the Southern Ocean. Probably the more recent one to China, simply because of the variety of conditions and the variety of navigational hazards we had as well. I mean, coming into Qingdao itself, you know, you're fishing fleets at night time. None of them have AIS, which is, you know, this automatic identification system where you can find them and you can tell how far they are and what speed they're doing. They don't really apply this knowledge or this technology in China. It's kind of a free-for-all, to be honest. And you don't know if they're paratrawling. You haven't a clue what they're doing. There's no such thing as even proper navigation lights in these boats. So, you know, you're doing 10, 15 knots sailing through a fishing fleet, and there's boats left and right and you're 50 feet away, and there's no one particular way. You just get through it, you know, and you navigate your way around. They don't really kind of move for you, so it's kind of, that was pretty interesting.
And I suppose the same is true when you come into somewhere like Singapore through the Straits of Malacca, which are very much in the news at the minute.
Kind of interesting. We sailed through that ocean like whatever it was 2.5 weeks ago, and now they're looking for a plane there. But yeah, again, coming into Singapore, I guess you have the probably... I mean, I always thought the Dover Straits were allegedly the kind of busiest straits in the world. I can tell and confirm now that's complete lies. The English Channel is easy to get across. You have about 7,000 AIS targets from ships and containers carrying all sorts of goods. There's things called VTSs. To get across this VTS is similar to a TSS where you have to ask permission to cross it. But Channel 16 is something like on a Joe Duffy show. So you can't get one word in edgeways. So even if you had a Mayday on 16, it's impossible. You just can't get a word in. So you kind of just gingerly go across it at 90, and then all of a sudden the VTS guys pick you up in AIS and go, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And you have to explain your situation. But you know, you're trying to go in there. It's a visual line of sight. I wouldn't like to even go through it during the fog. It would be just impossible to get through. I mean, 7,000 ships.
Now, you mentioned something spectacular about the night sky as well going into Singapore.
Yeah, it was something like out of a Steven Spielberg movie where you had these like flashing lights in the sky, and we sat there just in amazement for like 30 minutes looking at this, and everybody was like, "What is it, UFOs?" I mean, genuinely, it was just the most bizarre sight. But anyway, as it turned out, one of the guys lived in Singapore but didn't tell us for a while. There was the military were doing dogfights in the air with their F-16 fighters, and these were flares that were being left out the back of them, you know, for their kind of drills and practices. So it was another bizarre thing to look at, but it was lights everywhere.
Now, you sailed on quite a number of different vessels in the Clipper Around the World race so far. That in itself has been an experience. But you've also obviously seen a great deal of wildlife at sea.
Yeah, the wildlife actually was quite spectacular. A couple of, I think it was probably the east coast of Brazil was the most interesting. We came down there and it must have been migrations period for a lot of the whales. So you had these great humpback whales breaching and completely out of the water, 50 feet from the boat, to the point where there was so many whales at one stage, we passed through about 20 within an hour. We were on whale watch and we had two people on the bow going port starboard, port starboard. I mean, you're doing 25 knots with a kite up and you're trying to avoid these whales. Phenomenal. That was one. There was obviously dolphins and dolphins, lots and lots of dolphins, turtles, sunfish, but they also get the odd school of yellowfin tuna coming above, and they skim across the ocean. Amazing to see these big schools of tuna coming past you. And flying fish, which inevitably ended up on the deck quite a lot, and you know they unfortunately they died, but you know they're just everywhere. You'd be sitting at night time and you get hit in the back of the head by what you think is your guy sitting beside you going, "Hey, what are you doing?" No, it was actually a fish. They hit you in the back of the head. There's that many of them. Incredible, incredible sort of thing. I think for me, out of all of it, was two things: dealing with people and understanding that you're in a very small, 70-foot boat, but when you put 20 people in there, you have huge personality clashes. There's cold temperatures, there's hot temperatures, there's no escape, there's no running away. So you have to deal with all of this and at the same time maintain your professionalism that you are shooting a documentary. You are not sailing. You are not. You do get involved, obviously, because you can't film all day long, but essentially you're trying to document this. So there's rows and stuff going on board and you kind of have to shove a camera in people's face. So it was building a relationship with these people to let them be comfortable with you first and then being able to tell their story and what happens on board. And the other thing, I guess, was the safety factor. I thought I knew something, but as my good friend Marcus Hutchinson says, you don't know what you don't know until you know. And it's what no truer phrase ever said. I don't think I'd leave land again without the safety checks that I've learned from actually Clipper, which I would have probably ignored to begin with. But actually, you know, the stuff that you should consider when you go out to sea is incredible, and I don't know why I didn't know it beforehand, which is that I thought was a big, big learning curve for me. You run through an airport, it's fine, it's only for 5 minutes, but the more I started walking as I got back in the last 5 days, my legs were extremely tired and I couldn't understand what was going on. I said, "Geez, I'm really unfit." And you're not unfit because you're moving and it's all upper muscle or upper body strength you're building on in the boat. You're pulling yourself on this and, you know, so it's all upper body. What you don't realise is you don't do any walking. You can't walk more than 70 feet and you never go up the bow. It's normally from the cockpit to the back of the boat and that's really it. So there's essentially, you don't walk for 7 months. So yeah, your legs, obviously, the muscles in your legs need to kind of readjust to back to land. Bizarre kind of bizarre situation to be in, yeah. Stayed with a friend of mine for Christmas Day. We call it the Orphans' Christmas, and we went down to the beach. Another bizarre experience to have. You know, it's 35 degrees, and you're sitting on Bondi Beach having a barbecue with the rest of the rest of the Irish country there, practically. Yeah, it was great. I mean, I didn't have much time off at Christmas. I was running the stopovers in Hobart and in Brisbane, so I was on a flight on St. Stephen's Day to Hobart, where the boats were arriving in from the Sydney Hobart race. So it was short lived, and so was New Year's Eve as well. I was actually working. I was shooting the fireworks, and when the fireworks were over, I was going to bed. So it was a very intense period. I was working for most of it, but different. And the Sydney Hobart race itself, and the atmosphere and the crews, it's indescribable. I know there's only 90 boats, but there's very good reason for it, because of the safety checks that these boats need to go to. And I never understood why the Fastnet had 350, but the Sydney Hobart has only about 90 boats in it. But it obviously attracts the boats like Wild Oats right through to the smaller boats, maybe 40-footers. The safety after the 98 race, there was so much involved, and it's very expensive basically to get your boat ready for it, and that's the reason why. And half your crew must have certain courses done and all the rest. To be down there, and even though it's a small amount of boats, the people in Tasmania and Hobart put on an absolute massive show. You can't describe it. You got to be there. You got to go down. And if it's one thing you do in your life, even if you don't get to do the race, you have to go to the finish in Hobart. Incredible.
Now, you've a few abiding images, I'm sure, from your time, because obviously you spend a lot of your time looking through the lens. Are there a few of them that stand out for you?
I think there's been a couple. I mean, there was one published recently in Yachts and Yachting, and that was taken actually back in Biscay, which was a long time ago now, 25,000 miles ago. But it was a spectacular day. You know, it was champagne sailing. We had a kite up. We were doing 25, 26 knots, big swell in the Bay of Biscay, and big rollers and blue skies, blue water. It was incredible. But then again, I think a lot of the other good stuff came from this last trip over Papua New Guinea. The conditions weren't great. It was just spectacular backdrops. And yeah, it was some nice imagery from that as well, obviously. Thankfully, back in Europe for a while, and no more long distance travel. Yeah, I'm going out to see Andrea Brewster and Saskia Tidy. These girls have obviously putting together a very nice campaign for the 2016 Olympics. I've worked with them before, but they've decided to bring me out for a couple of days. We're going to shoot what's going to be hopefully a great video about the two girls, and we're going to kind of tell their story and let you know what's happening from there. So hopefully in the next 2 or 3 weeks, that material will be released, and then you'll be able to see what the girls have been working hard at for the last couple of months. When I first was asked to do this job, I decided, oh, what legs would I like to do? Now, anyway, I won't get on to how I ended up doing all of them, but this is how it happened. Panama was one I was looking forward to. Apparently, though, it's quite boring because you just drive through these lock gates and all the rest. But I don't know. I think for myself, you know, it's once in a lifetime. It's a centenary as well. So I think it's going to be quite spectacular. And thankfully, all of the hard slog is over, I think, in this Clipper race. I know the guys are in the middle of the North Pacific right now, and I know that's a difficult one. Once that's over, I think we're almost home in a way. And I know that sounds funny because we still have about 12,000 miles to go, but the conditions shouldn't be too bad. So it's going to be nice sailing. You know, we shouldn't have massive seas. We'll be back in shorts and T-shirts. You're going through Panama, which is, I'm sure, going to be amazing. And then into Jamaica for 7 or 8 days. I mean, you know, what else do you want? Into New York. It's going to be incredible. And then, yeah, hopefully my plan is to sail the boat across the Atlantic and finish my trip around the world in Derry. But there's it's tentative at the minute. There's lots of other situations going on, and there's other work around the world which I might have to cut my trip short to do. But time will tell and see what happens.
Brian Carlin, sailor and photographer. And we wish him fair sailing. You can read more about the Clipper Ventures Round the World Yacht Race on the Seascapes webpage. This coming week, from Monday, Annalise Murphy, Ryan Seaton, Matt McGovern and James Espy of Providence Team Ireland will take to the waters of the Bay of Palma for their first Sailing World Cup of the 2014 spring-summer season. Andrea Brewster, as we mentioned earlier, and Saskia Tidy are part of the ISA development programme, will take to the water after an intense winter training period. A record number of 882 sailors from 55 nations will race at the ISAF Sailing World Cup in Mallorca. The Palma Regatta will mark the beginning of an intensive 6-month training and competition programme for the team, culminating in the first Rio de Janeiro 2016 Olympic qualifier in Santander in northern Spain this September. We went down to the edge of the water. You were afraid to go in. You said there might be
sharks out there in the ocean, and I said I'm only going for a swim.
Sound of Sinead Lone and Mermaid. This Monday evening, yachtsman Pat Murphy will give an illustrated talk on the Asgard in Donaghmead Library, Donaghmead Shopping Centre on Dublin's north side. That takes place at 6:30, and you can read more on the Seascapes webpage. Dublin Bay, the cradle of yacht racing, rewriting the story of our sport, a public lecture by Hal Sisk, yachting historian, takes place on Thursday next, the 3rd of April, at 8 o'clock at the Poolbeg Yacht and Boat Club in Ringsend. Subscription is €5 in aid of the RNLI, and you can telephone 087 212 9614. That's 087 212 9614. Next week here on Seascapes, Hugh Oram remembers one of this island nation's great maritime advocates to coincide with the 6th anniversary of his passing, the late John de Courcy Ireland. We hear about an EU boat gathering with participants from Spain, France, Belgium and Ireland, hosted by Michael Mara. St. Michael's Rowing Club in Dúlaoire may need your help. Dublin Port plays host to Harbour Masters, and we've details of a cruise with a difference for heavy metal music fans, with Motorhead, Megadeth and Anthrax on board from Miami to Cozumel with no escape. All that and much more here on Seascapes next Friday night. Until then, tight lines and fair sailing.